For many years, Dr. Hyman Muss has been a champion of clinical breast cancer research focusing on older patients, and Dr. Muss is currently principal investigator of a major CALGB trial evaluating capecitabine as adjuvant therapy in older women. I met with Dr. Muss to obtain an update of this landmark trial, and he began our conversation by commenting on a related retrospective data set he presented at the last ASCO meeting.
What we did was we took three cancer and leukemia group B clinical trials that were done over a span of years, including 9344, which compared AC with or without paclitaxel, and some of the other studies. And we just looked, we had previously shown that the older women in these studies derived the same proportional benefit as the younger patients, as far as relapse-free survival and overall survival. For instance, if you had a woman over 65 who was on the paclitaxel-containing arm after AC, she showed similar benefit from paclitaxel, as did the younger patients in the study in aggregate. So we feel that age was not a variable that predicted for the benefit of chemotherapy, that older people did as well as young. Now, these are all node-positive trials. The patients are highly selected. So what we then did is we went back and we took three of the trials and we looked at detailed toxicity in three of the clinical trials. There were approximately 6,500 patients. Only about 8% were 65 and older, and only 2% was 70 and older. And so it sounds like, boy, those numbers are small. But when you really look what's out there, these are some of the largest numbers of patients looked at prospectively in a trial.
Scary, huh?
Yeah, scary. So we had about 24 deaths attributed to therapy. And when you do a big clinical trial and someone gets neutropenic fever and dies in the hospital, it's a catastrophe. And it's obviously therapy related. But if someone dies of heart trouble 4 years after anthracycline-containing therapy, is it related? So the 24 deaths attributed to therapy are coded for by the principal investigator. So it's his or her decision as to whether a death is treatment-related. And if you look at those numbers and you compare them with the size of the groups of the patients being treated, we found that the treatment-related death occurred in 1.5% of women 65 and older, but it's a wide confidence interval because it's only 7 patients, about 10 patients between 51 and 65, and in very few patients, 7 patients who were 50 and below. Now, that's the largest group in the trial. So proportionally, that death related to treatment in that younger group is like 0.2%. So if you do trend statistics, the older people have a higher probability of dying due to treatment. We also wanted to see if we could figure out a way to determine if older people could be dying later on of treatment-related toxicity, such as cardiac disease, leukemia, etc. Now, for leukemia, it's interesting. Of the 24 deaths, we didn't have one septic death attributed in these three trials. Probably that's good luck, because in the big trials, no matter who you are, there's always one patient or two who dies of a defined, well-used adjuvant program. But we didn't see it here. We saw a substantial amount of patients with acute leukemia, and they tended to be older patients. And the leukemia tended to fit in the right time range, 5 to 10 years, which is where you expect treatment-related leukemias to occur. And when you factored this out, the elderly had a higher risk of these leukemias than the younger patients.
Can you put a number on it?
Probably of the 7 older patients who died that were treatment related, I believe about 5 of them were leukemia. It's interesting.
So a 70-year-old woman's going to get those stents, AC, paclitaxel, and says, what's the chance this is going to cause leukemia? What do you say?
I think you got to say it's about a half to 1%. And to comment on that, in Dr. Huddis's update, last presentation of 9741, which is the dose stents trial, comparing the dose stents with the every 3 week regimens, the incidence of AML MDS in that trial is about 0.7%. You know, that's substantial. It's something we need to follow. So when you calculate an adjuvant online, a survival benefit of percent, and you're looking at dose stents therapy, you got to say that's probably going to be eaten up by the toxicity. So it is a concern. Now, the other problem is AML MDS is a disease of aging, and especially myelodysplasia and things. But this is an association which we really need to look at, especially in view of the 9741 data. We did a very interesting thing, though, to look at our older patients in this study. What we did is we took an older patient, let's say who's a 67-year-old woman, and we compared her mortality rate with a rate of a 67-year-old woman gotten from the Social Security database. So we looked at how our patients were doing. We took the total cohort of patients 65 and older, and we compared them with similar match patients from the Social Security Administration. And you can do a Kaplan-Meier curve out of the Social Security data. It's an actuarial curve. It's how MetLife sells you your policies. They know that if Dr. Love is a healthy 42-year-old guy, that his probability of not surviving till 52 is 1 or 2%. And so you can take those numbers for an average United States population right off the web, and you can create a curve, and then you can put our curve. And that's a good way to look and seeing if you're getting excess mortality from treatment. Because there's no way I know if 5 years out, if you have congestive heart failure, whether I'm certain it's treatment related or not. So you've got a whole group of patients to compare with a database that's from national data. That's the basis of our Social Security payout program. When we did that, the older patients in our trial actually had better survival than patients we took out of the Social Security Administration. Now, why? Because they're all performance status, 0 to 1, going in the trial. They all have been worked up with renal function, with CBCs. They've had physical exams. They've had chest x-rays as part of their breast. So they're pre-selected as a healthy. And then there's physician bias. When we looked at our prior studies in elderly patients in CLGB trials, we found that women 65 and older in the node-positive trials, that 25% of them had 10 or more positive nodes. The younger patients in those trials, which spanned many years, it was probably 10%. So where were the younger patients going? They were going on to high-dose chemotherapy and stem cell protocols, very aggressive other treatments. And so the women who got on the CLGB trials who were older tended to be higher risk.
Well, I guess that's not too big of a surprise.
No.
The bar is going to be raised when you have an older patient. What about the 75 to 85-year-old range? What do we know about that?
You know, we still know surprisingly little, have very little hard data. The most recent Oxford overview, in spite of the fact that it has close to 200,000 patients on randomized trials, has only about 1,200 women who were 70 and older on chemotherapy or not trials. And so if you look at the data there, they have a similar proportional reduction in relapse related to chemotherapy as women 60 to 69. But their margin of error, their standard deviation, is so great because the sample size is so small that you can't really say that that group derives similar benefit. It's too underpowered. And so there's a tremendous paucity of data in older patients, and this is a problem. We're doing a clinical trial through the intergroup, CTSU, with CLGB, looking at chemotherapy with the oral agent capecitabine versus standard therapy in women 65 years and older. And standard therapy in this trial is either CMF, utilizing an oral cyclophosphamide regimen a la Dr. Bonadonna, a la NCI for 6 months, or AC for 4 cycles, versus capecitabine at a dose of 2,000 per meter square for 14 days out of every 21 days for 6 cycles. Just before I came in here, I have an email that we've got 600 patients on that trial, which is our first cutoff for a Bayesian analysis to look whether to continue the trial or whether to stop it. So it'll depend. The DSMB will look at the data and look at the event rates. And if it looks as if the capecitabine regimen is highly improbable to be less effective than standard therapy, the study will be stopped. And if it's a slam dunk that either AC or CMF are better than capecitabine, it'll be stopped. If it's in the middle, we have it written to go on for several hundred more patients on the study. So we hope this analysis will be completed over the next several months and that this will be very helpful. But we still don't have lots of data on chemotherapy versus not in trials. The Europeans are doing several trials in hormone receptor patients looking at chemo or not. I hope they have better success than we would have with trials like this in the United States. But it'll be a long time in coming till we get these data.
And what's the total number of patients that you are thinking of recruiting or planning on recruiting?
So for the intergroup CLGB 49907 trial, we wrote the stats so the minimal number we would accrue would be 600. And we'll do this analysis to see if it's futile to continue, either because the treatments are highly unlikely to be different or one is going to be better than another. If not, we'll go up to about 900 patients and look at it again. If we still futile, we could conceivably get up to 1,200 patients, but I probably won't be surviving to present those data.
So there have been a lot of adjuvant trials that have had a lot less events than anticipated. Is that what you're seeing here?
Probably. You know, I'm the PI, and I feel morally obligated as a PI to be, even though there's a DSMB, to be looking at all the serious events and mortality rate. And a lot of patients have just been put on in the last year or two. And the eligibility criteria have been relaxed somewhat since inception. So my gut feeling is the event rate could be lower. I don't have the numbers. And this is going to influence, obviously, the power of these analyses to determine effectiveness of either the standard therapy or the capecitabine.
I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. It's been long in coming to get to the 600. Yeah.
Wow, so you actually might have some results.
It's true. The DSMB will look and give us a judgment. I should add that this is a big team event, this trial. The CTSU has accrued a lot of patients. And to me, not just the comparative question of the chemotherapy regimens is important. I mean, it's a great question to me because capecitabine is an oral single-agent drug. If equivalent to older but we know effective chemotherapy regimens would be a great option for many patients. But what's exciting is we have an incredibly rich database, including quality of life that Alice Kornblith has done with her colleagues with several hundred patients. We have a compliance study using an electronic pill bottle for capecitabine that includes like 150 or so patients that we've got the data on that Ann Partridge is doing.
When is that going to be ready?
I don't know if we have all the six cycles of the compliance on the capecitabine ready, but should be very shortly. We have indirect data on tamoxifen and other things, and we know compliance can be very variable.
What do you think you're going to see in terms of compliance with capecitabine here?
I think it's going to be pretty high.
My bias is it's pretty high. Knowing that they're doing electron, yeah. I mean, you know, they ought to be trying pretty hard.
I think to consent to go into this trial, you have to think about it, old or young, and probably there's a bias when you go in that you're going to do the therapy, that you're motivated enough to do it. Now, the problem with electronic pill bottles is we know when you opened it, but we don't know what you did with the pill. You know, it could be down the commode.
Right.
Apparently, there's technology to look whether you've taken it, short of looking at blood levels. But I think the compliance will be good. And obviously, another way indirectly to look at it will be a toxicity, to make sure that our toxicity numbers are similar to other trials of capecitabine as far as distribution of hand-foot syndrome, diarrhea, other potential toxicity.
So you don't have any of that toxicity data yet?
Well, we have it, but it's still data we haven't released. And that's going to be of great interest. Plus, we've got at least 20 forms we have developed that look at comorbidity detailed. We look at your functional status. We look at activities of daily living. Can you bathe yourself? Are you able to get around the house? Can you use the telephone? Things that are very important, especially in older patients. We have a lot of questions on perceptions of care. It's a wonderfully rich database. I'm hoping to have a trial that will come close to the record for publications over a 10-year period because of the richness of the database.
I'm sorry you're not doing the same study in younger people.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these questions, we don't know the answers to in general.
Right. And I should add another thing that'll be very helpful that may help us sort it out in younger people is Lynn Dressler has a companion protocol. So we have the blocks now, I believe, on 480 of the 600 women. And we are going to look at genetic predictors, for instance, of capecitabine effect, like thymidine phosphorylase, like DPD, and other enzymes involved in fluorouracil metabolism and capecitabine activation. It's going to be incredible. And then we're amending this to look at other genes and things that may be of interest as well. So we are going to have the paraffin-embedded tissues of about 500 women on these different regimens. It's going to give us an incredible amount of correlative data.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating. But I think the side effects and toxicity is going to be fascinating, too, because I'm really curious what you're going to see with the AC and the CMF.
Yeah.
I think it maybe is going to be more than what people expect.
Yeah. my bias from taking all the adverse event reports, which we pay great attention to, is that oral CMF, there is a lot of toxicity associated. There have been some studies, the Crivellari and colleagues in Europe, as part of the, I believe, International Breast Cancer Study Group study, used three cycles of CMF. And it's interesting, they didn't report any grade 4 toxicity, but they reported a lot of grade 3 toxicity. We're going to have grade 4 toxicity, there's no question.
Which specifically?
With CMF.
What types?
Myelosuppression, which can be rather substantial. You get to around day 8 in a lot of these patients. And probably some nausea, vomiting, and other things is my bias. We wouldn't code them in the SAEs that I've seen, but we periodically have put the toxicity in our reports, and I think we're going to get a very broad view of the tolerability, not only of the CMF, but the AC.
And you mentioned the data that was presented at ASCO on cardiac effects of adjuvant anthracyclines, and also looking at the issue of older patients, the comorbidities, cardiac risk factors. What was your take coming out of that?
It was a very good study that linked the SEER data registry with a death mortality registry, looking at cardiac deaths. And it was a very interesting study to me. I believe the presenter was Giordano and colleagues. And it's kind of similar to a lot of studies now, taking SEER data and linking them to some type of death registry or CMS information. And what it showed was that in women 65 and older, there were much higher risks of cardiac toxicity than one would expect in the general population. But what was very interesting to me was in the women who were 65 to 69 in a multivariate analysis, this incidence of CHF was much higher.
Yeah.
But in women 70 and above, it wasn't. So what bothers me about these studies is the SEER database is great. But when you start getting down to the individual patients and things, you don't have details like what are the doses, what are the other problems. And is just something totally not clear of seeing the toxicity in women, major problems between 65 and 69, and then not seeing increased incidence that's age-related at 70 and higher. And I don't have a good, plausible explanation for that. I've seen a lot of commentary on the abstract and things. I'm uncertain as to how serious a problem this is. And looking at our CLGB data, where we used anthracyclines and looked at it, at least we didn't see that as recorded by the investigator or matching it with Social Security data. The other cardiac data at the meeting was, I believe, looking at the Canadian trial, looking at CEF versus CMF, and looking at that trial, and there was substantial cardiac toxicity as measured by heart failure or other symptoms. But actually, the really serious cardiac disease was in less than 1% of the patients. So when it came down to CHF and not ejection fractions and other things, which to me are helpful, but as we see in the trastuzumab studies, the fact that your ejection fraction may have dropped with chemo by 10, even 20% may not have really a long-lasting effect on your quality of life. Certainly with trastuzumab, most of those people recovered. So I'm not certain how helpful these surrogate measures in telling the clinician about serious problems like CHF or perhaps angina related to CHF that's chemotherapy related.
So, you know, you have to take all the available data, which of course is not optimal, and distill that into what you're going to tell a patient.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious right now. Let's talk about just four cycles of AC. A patient who's in her 50s, completely healthy, what would you say to them in terms of what's the risk of cardiomyopathy? What would you say to a 65-year-old who has a long history of hypertension but no cardiac events?
Well, I would say in a woman at 50 who's very healthy, the risk of cardiac damage is minimal. Probably a serious cardiac damage, less than a half or a quarter percent. There's extensive data on FVC that the French have looked at. I think where it's tough is when you start getting people who may have diastolic dysfunction secondary to hypertension. And for me, who is older, you know, I always thought congestive heart failure had a big heart on x-ray and you came in to the emergency room and the clinical findings were clear and you had an S3. Now you're going to have normal cardiac size go into failure very quickly. And it's probably due to the fact that you don't have a distensible ventricle and you can't compensate and get the appropriate output, it's different. And apparently the data suggests that that's the most common cause of heart failure that we're seeing now in women.
That was a discussion that occurred.
I thought it was a superb discussion. I must say, in my own experience, I don't see a lot of my patients coming in with this flash cardiac failure and then coming back to me. We're not seeing it reported, for instance, in the AEs of the studies, because all hospitalizations for patients on clinical trials are now significant adverse events that go in. So I would...
But you must only have like a couple hundred or a few hundred people in AC.
Yes, that's true. But, you know, in the CLGB trials, of those 600 patients who were 65 and older, the vast majority, at least in the toxicity, they were all on anthracycline-containing regimens.
Right.
And some of them, like, for instance, in the AC with or without paclitaxel, the randomization there could have even been to 90 milligrams of doxorubicin every 3 weeks for four cycles, you know, substantial dose for a lot of people. So I think that someone who has hypertension, especially poorly controlled for many years, 50s, 60s, I might quote them a higher incidence of cardiac, you know, events. I'd be making it up, but I would say it could be as high as a few percent in those patients. And perhaps now with getting regimens that look effective, that don't contain anthracyclines, these would be better choices for some of these patients.
And of course, if this trial of yours pans out in terms of capecitabine, that's one non-anthracycline regimen. What were your thoughts about the TC, docetaxel cyclophosphamide regimen that was presented by Steve Jones from U.S. Oncology?
I'm very intrigued by the regimen, and I've used it in the study. I believe there were 1,000 patients on the study, and they were randomized to either four cycles of docetaxel, I believe it was 75 milligrams per meter square, and the cyclophosphamide was 600. Or standard AC. What was striking to me was the relapse-free survival favored the CT arm by about 5 to 6%. It's not powered well enough for overall survival, but you know, these p-values of 0.05 going for sainthood, if my broker could run it a 0.06, which means that if he assumed that that difference was real and the p-value was 0.06, it would mean he's going to be wrong 6 out of 100 as opposed to 5 out of 100. Anything he'd cold call me, I'd buy the stock. So I think that it's very impressive data, and I also like the toxicity profile of CT. So I've used it in several patients, and I've used it in some older patients. And there is the fatigue factor, which I believe is associated. And there was, I believe, about a 5 to 6% risk of neutropenic fever. And they didn't use growth factors, so my feeling is if I can appropriately get it for the patient to minimize risk, because it's adjuvant therapy, it's curative therapy, I want to minimize all potential risk. It's reasonable to consider it, but it was better by 5 percentage points or so than AC, and they have reasonably good follow-up. So I'm intrigued by that and feel that might be a very reasonable option for older people who you're reluctant to give anthracyclines. And hopefully the large intergroup trial looking at single-agent paclitaxel versus AC someday will also confirm indirectly the effectiveness of the taxanes as single agents, or combined in this case with cyclophosphamide versus AC regimens, especially shorter AC regimens, four cycles.
That study was among many, many that were kind of interestingly affected by the adjuvant trastuzumab data that came out, which came out right in the middle of your doing the study. How did you decide to deal with the HER2-positive patients?
So now we've amended virtually all national trials, whether they're intergroup trials, to allow trastuzumab. So we never excluded trastuzumab. So even before we amended the trial, which now has 14 amendments on it, we've learned a lot doing this trial, trastuzumab administration is fine for patients. We have some guidelines in there. If you wanted to do it every 3 weeks after therapy, that's fine.
But it's got to be after the chemo.
We're doing it after the chemo.
Including
yeah.
the capecitabine.
Yeah.
Interesting. What are your thoughts about the work that's coming out of Memorial looking at capecitabine 1 week on, 1 week off, the so-called dose-dense capecitabine?
Yeah. Well, it's intriguing. I've seen some of the preclinical data. I think I've seen either Larry Norton or Cliff Huddis show some of the models, and it's very, very intriguing. And maybe that's a better way to do it. You know, I think capecitabine is a drug to me which is extremely effective. I mean, I'm a fan of the drug, and I will say I have no industry interest in this at all and own no stock, but I like it. It's an oral agent. I think capecitabine, we've used a fixed dose and we've gotten into a fixed schedule. I think there's a lot more we can learn about this drug. For instance, would capecitabine be a good choice for metronomic low-dose chemotherapy to give over a long period of time in a lower dose? I'm not sure we know the optimal dose or threshold dose of capecitabine. I personally have treated Mets, and I have one woman I treated with metastatic disease. She was in her 80s with 500 BID because she said, if I get the least bit sick from your treatment, I'm never coming back to see you. And I figured I could risk extensive pulmonary Mets. I figured I could risk it. And she got a response that lasted about 9 months. When she came back without toxicity, I said, even though maybe if we push it up, we do better. Of course, she was logical. She said, why? Why would you want to do it? So I think we still have a lot of fundamental biology to learn about capecitabine, and that there may be better ways to do it. And perhaps the dose-dense approach that follows a lot of Larry Norton's work and mathematical models is going to be a better way.
Now, of course, this study is looking at capecitabine as a substitute, presumably.
Right.
And what about adding capecitabine into some of the existing regimens, for example, following, for example, dose-dense AC paclitaxel? We used to have the old CAF, and, you know, 5-FU got dropped out along the way. Do you see that question being studied?
There are trials in progress now utilizing capecitabine in addition to taxanes. I know there's an AC followed by T,
right,
or XT.
Right, right.
I think it leans on the phase 3 data that have been published by Joyce O'Shaughnessy, where at least when you're talking about responses and potential curable patients in the adjuvant setting, the combination makes a lot of sense. So I think that's a great place to explore capecitabine upfront in addition to other agents, and perhaps to think of non-anthracycline capecitabine regimens with taxanes, with gemcitabine, with other agents that we traditionally haven't used that could be highly effective. Because we do share concerns, like we've learned in children, certainly anthracyclines in children carry high risks of cardiac toxicity later on in life. I think adults are tougher to really figure this out well in, because heart disease is part of the culture, and most of the patients with cancer are older. And unless something is very obviously and temporally related within weeks to months of the drug, figuring out years later whether we had any downside is tougher with anthracyclines and cardiac toxicity.
Now, you mentioned that you're a, quote, fan of capecitabine. And in fact, there are a lot of breast cancer clinical researchers who are fans of capecitabine. We know that from our patterns of care studies, where we are surveying up to close to 50 researchers. And it was interesting because prior to ASCO 2005 with the bevacizumab paclitaxel data, we were saying that actually capecitabine was first-line therapy for a lot of clinical investigators in metastatic disease, a lot more than practicing oncologists. Now there's like a little bit more question in the field because bevacizumab's out there with the Bev data. How have you sorted that through?
That's a great question. When we looked at capecitabine with bevacizumab in previous trials, we did a trial comparing capecitabine-bevacizumab with capecitabine alone. But virtually all those patients, it was second line or further therapy. And it was interesting, the response rates were a little bit better. We didn't see what was the really impressive changes in time to progression and perhaps a survival advantage in the long run that we've seen in the paclitaxel bevacizumab trial. But it was second line therapy, so there was a hint of activity there, even second line. The bevacizumab paclitaxel is really impressive data with improvements in response rate, doubling of time to progression for about 11 months, which is not longer than every trial that's been published, but in randomized trials with large numbers, that's among the best time to progression you see. And with concerns of toxicity, hypertension, and other things with bevacizumab, but really manageable compared to what you see with a lot of the other chemotherapy agents. So I think, to me, that's made our decisions harder. You know, before the bevacizumab trial, I would use capecitabine first line for most patients. The truth is, whether you're 25 with metastatic breast cancer or 85, it's palliative therapy. And taking someone who's generally been through adjuvant therapy and now who does not have curable disease and getting them used to the fact that they have a serious problem that's not going to go away, but treating them appropriately with a drug that doesn't cause hair loss, that usually doesn't cause myelosuppression, and that can maintain a pretty good quality of life when you've just been hit with the terrible news that you have an incurable metastatic breast cancer, to me seems like a very good way to take good care of patients. The bevacizumab data is very intriguing. I still think for many patients, there's a potential role for capecitabine up front. I'd love to see the capecitabine trial redone up front with bevacizumab.
Well, we are going to see that.
And I know it's in the works because I feel, you know, you do second line. Virtually all trials of second line chemotherapy, half the responses of first line. So I think it's intriguing. And I think in many people, I still might try the capecitabine, because it's an oral regimen. It's going to be less toxic in general than paclitaxel, which is given with the bevacizumab. And so I think you need to sort it out with patients. It'd be nice to know the effectiveness of paclitaxel and bevacizumab second line in people who have had capecitabine. But I think the probability of seeing a big trial like that is probably small.
And of course, the issues of cost and reimbursement always make this whole discussion kind of tricky. But putting that aside and focusing on clinical science, would there be situations where you would want to give capecitabine and bevacizumab together?
Well, I think outside of the trial first line, I probably wouldn't do it. I think if the patient was symptomatic enough or had a very aggressive rate of change or a metastatic disease, very short free interval, multiple organ involvement, I think these days you rarely see visceral crisis where one doubling will be a patient who is not going to survive her cancer. Usually today with our frequency of visits and monitoring of patients, I think it's unusual for someone to show up who's critically ill with mets. It happens a few times a year. So I would say for someone with a very slow tempo of disease and things, I'd still consider doing capecitabine singly. I think for many of the patients where it's a little bit more aggressive, I think following on the paclitaxel bevacizumab may turn out to be a better strategy up front.
What about paclitaxel, capecitabine, and bevacizumab?
Yeah. It's intriguing, but I think the paclitaxel and capecitabine is going to be more toxic than capecitabine alone. So perhaps now if you had a patient, multi-organ involvement, major symptoms, that would be certainly something worthy of study in a trial and worthy of consideration. I don't know if I would feel compelled to do that off a study.
What are some of the other clinical trials out there in the CALGB and elsewhere right now that are ongoing that have you the most excited?
Well, I think there's going to be some exciting adjuvant trials that are coming up, looking at lapatinib and bevacizumab up front in HER2 patients with trastuzumab and without it. I think it's exciting because to me, the nice things about drugs like bevacizumab and some of the other biologics is although we need to be concerned about their toxicity profiles, we can't minimize it. They're much less in general than we see with other chemotherapy drugs. And so management of hypertension, probably oncologists will get very good at it. And I think those are very exciting. I think some of the lapatinib data is very exciting. It potentially can add to the effects of trastuzumab. Very exciting to me to look at that. I think, though, the bulk of our patients aren't going to be HER2 positive. And integrating, I think a lot of the trials we looked at, looking at capecitabine in addition to paclitaxel after AC, our success has been small iterations. A trial shows a 5% benefit with X, and then we add Y, and that trial shows 5% benefit, as Don Berry so eloquently showed in his analysis of trials of the CLGB. So I think some of the more active agents, bringing them up front, the current B38 trial looking at gemcitabine, in addition to paclitaxel as a third arm versus TAC
with
and dose-dense therapy.
Right.
Exciting. Maybe it'll add a few percent, and that will be very compelling. And then adding biologics to that is very exciting. A lot of good trials on the drawing board. The question is the designs, the thousands of patients needed, and the complexity of the data to please everybody with a good design.
What trials would you like to see get done if you had the funding?
I'm biased towards the elderly. I'd like to look at some non-anthracycline regimens. I think if the capecitabine is good, turns out to be as good as standard therapy or perhaps even better, that I'd like to add that perhaps to a taxane and look at that up front, maybe against capecitabine alone. I think that certainly some of the new taxane preparations like nab-paclitaxel that minimize toxicity would be exciting. Perhaps they're a little bit better.
Let me just pause on that point. I'm curious, what are your thoughts about nab-paclitaxel as opposed to paclitaxel in the elderly specifically? And how much of an issue do you think premedications are in the elderly?
I don't know if pre-medications are a great issue, but probably today in the United States, very few people are giving every three-week paclitaxel. I suspect most people are giving it weekly, and they do it for 3 weeks out of four or 6 weeks out of eight or something. So each time any of the people are getting dexamethasone or other glucocorticoids to suppress allergic reactions, even though there is some data and people frequently after several cycles and people doing fine minimize this treatment. So I think you take an older person and you give them dexamethasone and Benadryl every week. It can add over time and affect their quality of life. I think the paclitaxel is intriguing because it minimizes the amount of treatments and complexity of the nursing care and pre-medication, which is a big deal in many offices. And I think biologically it's intriguing that it may be a better delivery system, maybe the active transport, the spark, you know, all the things that are so interesting about these microalbumin formulations. So I think that it holds some advantages. Obviously, cost is a big issue in the United States today, and these are much more expensive drugs than buying generic paclitaxel. But assuming we can overcome or at least deal with those issues, I think it's a very exciting agent. And I think minimizing the risk of hypersensitivity reactions is important. All of us have seen that occasional serious reaction, even after weeks and months of taxanes, of carboplatin. They're why we have crash carts in clinics, and I think that's important. I don't want to overstate the case, but I personally think it's important.
Yeah, it's interesting because the cost issue just is so strong, you can't ignore it. But if there was some way to put it aside, it really gets into the issue of how much research do we need to prove that something similar, for example, in colon, do we need to do an adjuvant trial in capecitabine for every time 5-FU is utilized? And I guess it looks like in terms of paclitaxel versus NAB that we are going to go down the route of getting a lot more data before utilizing it, particularly in the adjuvant setting.
Yeah.
You think that makes sense? I mean, again, putting aside the cost thing, is it worth our research dollars to be doing that?
Well, I saw that a recent FDA review looked at a lot of the data and said it has different pharmacology.
Right.
I mean, I don't think we need to do that on everything, but I think if you look at published clinical trials of nab-paclitaxel in breast cancer, it's not like you've got 20 trials there. I think at capecitabine, we don't need to do it anymore. We know a lot about risks of DPD and management of toxicity, whether it's colorectal cancer or breast cancer, but I think we don't have lots of published trials yet in nab-paclitaxel. So I think some caution is not ill-advised here. But I think if we can get some data that we don't have to reinvent a 5,000-patient trial to prove every point, because I don't think it's feasible.
I'm curious, and you've been really championing the whole issue of the elderly and clinical trials in the elderly. What do we know about the interest that older people have in participating in studies?
We don't know a lot, but we have some intriguing data. The CLGB did a trial. Peggy Kemeny led this trial. And there's been one or two other trials looking at older people who offered trials of chemotherapy. First, we know that there is a specific age bias, even after multivariate analysis. And we learned this even in our top CLGB institutions, that where we knew the patients were eligible for a trial that were elderly, and we compared women 65 and older with younger women, we found elderly were offered trials about a third of the time. The younger women were offered trials about a half of the time, which is not great for the younger women either. But interestingly, it wasn't a large number of patients, but it was a reasonable sample. We found that when you offer trials to patients, the take was about 50%, whether you were older or younger. There's been some other data that also suggests the elderly are presented with options for clinical trials. They will consider them, and probably their rate of participation is similar to younger patients. Now, I think it'll certainly depend on the trial. You know, if it's a transplant trial, 60 miles from home for lymphoma, you're probably not going to get a lot of elderly people. But we have learned, and I think there is ample data, to know that elderly people, older people, who don't have severe comorbidity or functional disability and who can meet reasonably strict eligibility criteria, normal CBC, good renal function, good hepatic function, that they will tolerate many of the standard chemotherapy regimens we have about as well as younger people. So I am a champion of offering older people trials, perhaps not all trials, but I'm also realistic in thinking that we need to think of designing new trials focused on older people, especially in their late 70s, early 80s, metastases, who have other issues, that we need to focus on them and design trials with kindler, gentler therapy that allow us to factor in the effects of comorbidity, and we have a shortage of that.
Right now, what's the age breakdown in the CLGB study? What fraction are 65 to 70?
That's a great question. I have on my little cards, get a histogram of the ages. We did build in that if once we got a certain amount of patients between 65 and 70, that we would close it to that group so we didn't have all people who were 66. And we have not had to address that. So I don't have that data at my fingertips. Only the DSMV knows these things. But I'm going to request that we get that to look at it. I think from looking at all the case reports coming in and the on-study forms, we're going to have a pretty good mix of people. We're going to have a lot of people in their 70s.
Is there sort of a number in your mind where even in a patient who is in good condition, has good renal status, et cetera, using chemotherapy is starting to kind of not make sense from your point of view? Is it 75? Is it 85? It's interesting to ask docs, what's the oldest patient you've given adjuvant chemo to? When you start getting up around 80, it's about where people just stop using it. Do you think that makes sense?
If you look at retrospective data on elderly on trials, and there's some good SEER data, again, suffering from lack of fine-tuning of what regimen, what doses. But if you look at the data, it will be a rare older patient with an ER-positive, node-negative breast cancer that gets any major value from chemo. In fact, it may be very few people in their 60s. And certainly what's so interesting is the Oncotype DX and the Taylor RX trial that's going on. I believe a lot of those people are going to be older people that go in that. So I think that those people will rarely derive benefit. Oh, there might be someone who's 66 and has a 12-centimeter tumor that's ER-positive, and they're very few, very few. If you look at ER-negative, PR-negative, node-negative in some of these trials, probably the vast majority of those patients don't benefit, but I would consider therapy in someone who had a 4-centimeter poorly differentiated tumor. I think Adjuvant Online is very accurate in telling you the risk of recurrence, where the Vancouver data, which they used to validate Adjuvant Online, did not really hold up well, was the added value of chemotherapy in postmenopausal women. Maybe it overestimates the value of chemotherapy. And there's a lot of extrapolation in looking at third-generation regimens in Adjuvant Online, like TAC and dose-dense therapy. We have really a paucity of data in older people, because when you put that in, you sometimes see improvements in survival that really don't jive with what you've seen in the clinical data available. So I think they might be worthy of consideration high risk. When you get to node-positive, ER-positive patients, the data's iffy. In the big SEER trial, the p-value wasn't significant, but there was a hazard ratio that favored some of the chemotherapy. If you look at the overview data at 15 years, at least the last Oxford publication, there is an added value of chemotherapy in ER-positive and ER-negative patients. And interestingly, in the overview, by 15 years, that proportional reduction in risk due to chemotherapy is similar in those patients, which is often unappreciated when you read that overview analysis. So I think in these patients, there's potential for benefit, especially larger tumors, poor features, and high risk, even if they're ER and PR positive. Where chemotherapy is very valuable is in healthy elders with ER, PR negative, node positive tumors. They're not a large group, but there the SEER data and other data we have are pretty compelling. So I urge people to use Adjuvant Online, because I think a lot of medical oncologists overestimate the benefits of chemotherapy in older patients, especially hormone receptor positive. And one of the nice things that Dr. Ravden has done in Adjuvant Online is he has factored in U.S. census data into the age.
Right.
So the nice thing about the model is when you put in the 81-year-old patient, you will get a nice list of what their chances of dying of breast cancer, which in this node-negative, ER-positive, 1.5-centimeter tumor is negligible, versus dying of something else. And that's data that's been highly reproduced in numerous trials and SEER databases and CME databases. So I urge people to look at that in making their decisions. It can be helpful.
Hell, a lot of people are looking at it. So I got to ask you, what's the oldest patient you give an adjuvant chemo to?
I would say probably 80, 81. And I tell you, I'm always ambivalent there. There are very few people who walk in 80, 81 with no drugs on their card who are really in great, great shape. But if you have a healthy 80-year-old patient today, they're probably going to live 5 to 10 years on average from the data we have. So if they have a huge bad tumor,
ER negative.
Get called, 21 positive nodes, ER negative.
That's it.
Plays tennis.
Yep.
Go over the side effects. It's reasonable to do it. In fact, I just talked with someone earlier today about this, and I think you've got to have an informed patient. I would use programs like Adjuvant Online to make reasonable estimates. I go over the toxicity carefully, but patient understands it. Those numbers look good. I go for it.
Generally speaking, in that patient with ER negative, PR negative, multiple node positive, what regimen are you going to be using?
Well, that's a great question, because I've got this study where they're eligible for capecitabine versus standard therapy. I mean, that would be very reasonable, in my opinion. It also would be reasonable to give them some of the more aggressive therapies, depending on their functional status. I actually like the CT regimen that we talked about earlier, because I like the ability of moving away from anthracyclines on a regimen that looked somewhat better, like a second generation difference from AC. So that's intriguing to me. And if it was a patient in great shape with a terrible outlook, to think of dose-dense therapy or using something like the Paxo-1, three cycles of FEC and three cycles of docetaxel or perhaps TAC, I wouldn't be highly critical of someone, but it would have to be a very carefully selected patient.
Now, the CALGB elderly study 49907 does not allow dose-dense AC, correct?
Correct.
Although there is the other CALGB study that's actually using dose-dense AC.
Exactly.
I know you're a dose-dense type of person who've seen people go through AC dose-dense, seemingly do better than non-dose-dense or using dose-dense AC without a taxane. What do you think about that strategy, particularly in the older patient?
I think it's reasonable to use. We took a quantum leap in our intergroup study to not have an every 3-week AC arm, and I hope it doesn't haunt us, because really there isn't an anchor arm when everybody's dose-dense. But I think that it certainly makes excellent sense from kinetic models of breast cancer growth. And what I like about the dose-dense, and I think if you're considering AC, why it's fine in elderly, there weren't any differences in cardiac toxicity in the CLGB 9741 trial of dose-dense versus every 3 weeks. There were no differences in leukemia among the arms of the dose-dense and non-dose-dense arms. The fact is that you're much more likely to maintain the patient's counts. And so when I give dose-dense therapy, I tend to write every appointment up for the whole regimen to save places on my schedule. Whereas every 3-week therapy, I just say, we'll do 3 weeks because counts are low, there's other issues. So dose-dense, we know from our trials that only about 3-5% of patients are not likely to stay on the schedule. So it's much more predictable that their counts will be good. I think it makes it a little bit easier for your care. And I don't see a great downside. I can't believe we're going to have drastic differences in outcome by changing that regimen from every 3 weeks on the negative side. That would be hard for me to assume. And that's the only way, to me, you could make a compelling case that it doesn't pay to use it.